It's that unruffled beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch that signals it is 8 p.m. Thursday and time once again for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling. And it's only here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host tonight, Greg Audell, and alongside a team saturated in talent, Drs. Hank Rubicek, Warren Holloman, and Mary Edgerton, and standout guest hosts Eric Keen, Christy Gorman, and Harwood Taylor, and ace engineer Tatiana Gago, and of course Floyd the Wonder Dog. We celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who show us how stories connect us. Happy Thanksgiving to all of you. We hope today is filled with everything you hoped it would be and far too many calories. During the past 2 weeks, we explored the magic found in both messages within a story and human connection, respectively. Tonight, we combine those themes and put them where they rightly belong, on our family and friends. You'll hear stories of love that will resonate through the upcoming holiday season and well beyond. This first story comes from the heart in more ways than one, because Annie Garcia runs a nonprofit called Heart Advocate for Children. In a program aired May 7th, 2015, she delivered this moving narrative about her daughter, for whom she is more thankful than words can possibly convey. Although these words do a pretty darn good job. Let's listen to Anne's story.
When I was a little girl, I was fixated on pregnancy. I wasn't so much into playing doll and being a mother, but pregnancy was just really just very interesting to me. And so when I was a little girl, I would tuck a pillow under my shirt and I'd walk around pretend like I was pregnant, much to my mother's embarrassment, and probably my neighbor's concern as well. What is a five-year-old girl doing pretending like she's knocked up? I don't know. But I was always wanting to be pregnant. And when the stars aligned and I found my husband, an incredible man, and everything was set, I was on the cusp of starting our own family. I was really excited and I was very happy about it. And we didn't have a hard time getting pregnant. And so we were off to the races shortly after we got married, and I enjoyed every moment of the experience and it culminating in my son's birth. And I'm not one of these women who can say that she just, you know, sneezed and a baby was born. It was hard work, but it was also this incredible experience where it was just beyond anything. It was one plus one, my husband and me made three all of a sudden. And it was just an incredible experience. And from there, we knew that we wanted to have more kids. And, so we started trying soon after our son Hugo was born. And again, it didn't take much, two margaritas this time. And I was pregnant with Ari. And unlike with Hugo, because I was looking after, a 6-month-old baby, I couldn't really enjoy the pregnancy as much, but it was still a great experience. And Ari looked, everything looked perfect during our pregnancy. And when she was born, I think she probably set a record. I started having my first contraction at 4:23 in the morning, and by 5:12 she was born. In fact, she beat the midwife. So I was the first person to touch her, to feel my baby daughter in my hands, and it was profound. It was an incredible experience. And so we were now a perfect family of four. We had our son, and then we had our little girl, and everything was going perfectly. She looked great. There was one thing where she would, in the evening, have allergies. Both my husband and I have horrible allergies, and she seemed to also suffer from allergies, and so she would have a hard time breathing. And we would read up online, you know, usually at 2:00 in the morning, and everything said, you know, it's fine, don't worry about it, and try these different remedies, and we did, and usually it worked. But one evening, it didn't work. And in the morning, my husband said, you know, that at some point in the evening, she had gone limp in his arms, and this set off alarm bells for both of us. So I ended up taking her into the emergency room, and, the doctors started questioning me immediately. Well, she must not be breastfeeding. No, she's breastfeeding. Well, you know, she's been vomiting all night, hasn't she? No, she hasn't vomited at all. And the entire time they're firing these questions at me, I'm getting more and more alarmed. And she's surrounded at one point by about 20 doctors and tiny little baby on this adult-sized gurney. And I called my husband, who had stayed at home with our son Hugo, and I said, you need to get here. They said it's bad. And I didn't know what that meant, and no one would tell me. And finally I asked the nurse, I said, you know, what are we looking at? Is she going to die? And she just shrugged her shoulders and then walked away from me. We eventually figured out that there was something wrong with her heart. It was the first time that we had any indication of that, and they told us that they needed to move her to another hospital, which they did. They allowed me to kiss her and hug her, and I realized that at that point they didn't think she was going to make it. We went to another hospital. We waited for about 3 hours. Meanwhile, my son is just losing it. He's, you know, tired, hungry, you know, 10 months old. And finally, my husband went to the back, and he brought out a doctor. And when the doctor saw us, she looked over at my son, and she said to another doctor, well, at least they're still going to have one child. And I felt my heart drop, and my blood just went cold, and I braced myself. When I was following her into the other room, I was prepared. I was prepared to hear what she was going to tell me, that Ari was dead. We got into the room, and there were more doctors there. And one sat down, he started drawing a heart for me, and he started telling us that she had something called transposition of the great arteries, and that it would require immediate intervention. And we asked, okay, well, when do we start? And he said, oh, no, they've already started. And later I went back to him and I said, well, when we had that conversation, what were her odds? And he initially wouldn't tell me. And finally he was like, you know, we thought she was going to be died. She was going to be dead. It was a very scary 2 weeks, I would say. She was up and she was down. The peeps and the chirps of all the machines surrounding her would set me into a tailspin, and I couldn't make heads or tails of any of it. Eventually, we'd find out that she had suffered some brain damage from the reduction in oxygen that was a result from the underlying heart defect. And going through this experience, I realized that we were really lucky, ironically, I guess. But we were lucky because we saw children in beds next to us die. And we heard stories of kids whose heart defects were so much more complicated than our Ari's. And it was in recognizing how lucky we were that we decided that we needed to do something, that we wanted to help other families. And we were going to take a portion of the overall cost that we would have incurred had we had to pay for the surgery as ourselves, and we're going to apply it to helping other kids. And that was really the impetus for Op Heart.
This is Hank, everybody. Greg sounds a lot better than I do tonight, so you're going to be able to tell us apart. But I remember when Annie was on the show, you know, love is absolutely unselfishness. I mean, that's what it is, simply put. And I remember thinking about that as that story unfolded in her mind. Caring more about the welfare of another is something that I heard in that story. And it really did define Annie's love. And I know that her daughter has got to feel that thanks now, because that was a few years ago. Greg, you told a story a while back that was showcased on the Moth Radio Hour, a story that resonates with anyone who understands the love that comes from simply being present. And there's a lot to say about you in this story as well. Tell us that story.
I will. And before I start, let me just say I'm really happy to be spending Thanksgiving with you on air, Hank. I love it on the rare occasion we get to do a show together.
Thank you.
It's good for my soul. You know, when I was young, I was blessed or cursed, I think, with a self-awareness that knew where the strengths were in my life and the deficiencies. I knew I had a great mother and a great sister, and I knew from about 9 years old or 8 years old that my father may have many good abilities when it came to aerospace and NASA, but unfortunately, being a dad or a healthy, functioning human being was not among the things that he could do. So when I was 12 and found out my parents were divorcing, I was kind of happy because I was had a list of stepdads that I was ready for my mom to start dating and pursuing. But unfortunately, she told me that since she had become a lesbian, she thought maybe these men would have a problem with it. I tried to explain it to her that that was her problem. They'd be fine with it. She was pretty sure they wouldn't be fine with it. It was important to her that my father and I spend time together to try and create a non-existent relationship. What she didn't realize is at the ages of 12, 13, and 14, 100% of the time I spent with him was in bars and strip clubs. And I worked hard to make sure she didn't find that out because, you know, I also thought it was important to spend time with him. But I wouldn't say I was getting any of the father-son benefits out of it. He also wasn't paying much in the way of child support, so my mother did what she had to do, worked night and day with two teenagers, which resulted in me spending a lot of time alone and living on frozen pizzas, 3 liters of Coca-Cola every day, and not going to school when I didn't want to. I was lucky that at the age of 14, I was accepted in the High School for the Performing Arts in Houston, and I met a friend who lived nearby me. I lived in Friendswood. He lived a few miles further, and I was able to ride into town with he and his dad every day. And I noticed that his dad was kind of a busybody. He would ask him these really obnoxious questions, like after school he'd say, "How was school today? Do you have any homework to do? Did you get your chores done?" I would ask my buddy, I was like, "Why do you put up with that?" He looked at me like I had three heads. He didn't understand what I was talking about. I said, "Is that really any of your father's business?" I said, "Why don't you just tell him, you know, to mind his own business?" And he said it didn't really work that way in his family. Well, one night, for some reason, it was just a few weeks into school, I ended up spending the night on a school night with the family. And I walked in, and there was food on the table, and we were told to go do our homework before dinner. I had never done homework before. That was kind of interesting, but it was quaint, so we went and did it. And then after dinner, we played video games, we watched TV, and at 9:45, his father came in, and he said, "Guys, it's time to get ready for bed. You got 15 minutes before lights out." To this day, I can't explain what happened in my body and my soul and my psyche, but something fundamentally changed. Out of nowhere, I burst into tears. I started sobbing. I said to my buddy, I said, "Do your parents always act like this?" He's like, "Act like what?" He's like, "I don't know. People sat around and talked at dinner. There was food there. And does your dad always tell you when to go to bed?" He's like, "Yeah." I said, "Would you mind if I stayed tomorrow night?" He said, "You know, my folks already said that you can stay as long as you want." So, off and on, I stayed for 3.5 years. Their rules became my rules. Their discipline became my discipline. And that was the most important lesson I learned at that age that's held true to my life, that family is, the family you're born with is important, but so is the family you choose to become a part of. And my life would be so much less if I didn't have these amazing people that chose me as part of their family and that I was able to choose as part of mine.
Yeah. You know, a good story is like a good movie. You can't get enough of it. You watch it all the time and you hear something different all the time. And that's the way your story is. I love your story. And there's always something different that I hear. You know, you spent a lot of time, Greg, with who you referred to as your kiddos recently. And when you do, you always have this light in your eyes. Tell us about them.
Well, you know, one thing I think about is you want to be the person you needed to have in your life when you were a kid. And so I'm lucky. I've got kids in my life. Each one of them I've known since the very day they were born. And they are 2 years old, 6 years old, 11, 13, 16, 24, and 26. And some of them I share blood with, some of them I don't. And as a wise person once said about when they were asked which of their children were adopted, they said, you know, I can't really remember right now. But they're all my kids in one way or another. They're all, you know, surrogate nieces and nephews, and they just make my life exponentially better and more fun, and I hope I do the same thing for them.
Yeah, I love hearing that. And there's a reason I ask you, too, because as a dad, I know that it's the most important job that we have, and in your case, the definition of a father has a really wide range. A former student of mine, Stephen Winkler, told this moving story about his father on March 5th, 2015.
So, as you know, my father played a huge role in my life. He's the smartest man I know, always ready with a joke, and anytime I needed his support, he was there to give it to me. And it's thanks to him that I am the man I am today, and I thank him so much for being a part of my life. But unfortunately, about a year ago, my brother called me, letting me know that he would no longer be with us. 3 days or 2 days earlier to that call, my father was placed in the ICU, where he was placed in there for a severe case of the flu and some chest pains. My brother and I went to go visit him immediately, and while he was sick, he seemed so full of life. He smiled at us and was happy to see us, and we greeted him as we entered in. And as we asked him how he was doing, he quickly changed the conversation to let us know what we should do in case anything were to happen to him. Things like what we should do with the house, how to take care of my mother, and how I'd continue my education, which was a very important thing in him. So while all this was hard to hear, I didn't believe any of it. I have been through this before with him and other family members, and we've made full recoveries. So any advice he gave me, I took with a grain of salt. But one thing he said really stuck with me. He said, I'm very proud of you, and I think you know that. Now, normally, anyone is striving to make the people that are their role models proud, and they live for that moment of acceptance, but something sour was about this. It didn't feel, you know, it was more dread than it was hope and happiness, and I just couldn't figure it out. And I didn't have much time to reflect on that as the doctor came to take him away for procedures. So we left for the day. The next day, though, I thought about what he said, and it felt like he was telling me that his job was complete in making the man I am today. But for me, it wasn't. I still had so much to learn from him, so much to do with him, and I relied on the future to give me those experiences. I still couldn't believe anything could happen to the Superman that was my dad, but after that phone call, I had no choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
The hardest thing in life is seeing the most important person lie there still. It just kills you inside. And I just couldn't take it. But I asked the staff to give me some time and privacy with them, and they closed the curtains to do so. And as I held his still warm hand, I could only think of one thing to say. I'm not done making you proud. And I've said that every day since. I'm not done making you proud. Because he still makes me the man I am today. And for that, my job has only just begun.
You know, I've always talk about stories like these stretching the boundaries of the human heart, and I think that really proves it. You know, I got a sappy little tale that just works to celebrate this day. Mrs. Turner's Pumpkin Pie by Judy Solomon. When I get off the bus and there's a chocolatey smell coming from Mrs. Turner's back porch, I can tell that she's been baking. If I hop up on the bench at the bus stop, I can see whatever she's been cooking sitting on the front porch rail to cool. Come on over, Jonathan, and have a cookie, she'd call to me, and then while I'm eating cookies and drinking milk, I'd tell Mrs. Turner about my day at school. Sometimes she shows me a letter or a new picture and tells me about her grandchildren. One day, Mitch and Jojo got off the school bus at my stop so we could play soccer in the field behind Mr. Marshall's store. Hey, what's that smell? Asked Mitch. Smells great, said Jojo. It's coming from over there. Well, Mrs. Turner had been baking again, but this time it didn't smell like chocolate. The smell was more like Mom's cinnamon toast. We all walked over to Mrs. Turner's fence. Mitch and JoJo went into the backyard, and Mitch climbed up on Mrs. Turner's porch. "It's a pumpkin pie," he whispered. "Let's take it." Mitch passed the warm pie to JoJo and jumped off the porch. "Hey, put the pie back," I said. "What's the matter?" asked Mitch. "You chicken?" Mitch and JoJo made chicken noises. "Bawk, bawk!" Mitch flapped his elbows and down. "Could I let him call me a chicken?" "Give me that pie," I said. Well, JoJo handed me the pie, and I carried it all the way to the soccer field. When we got there, we broke the pie up in pieces and ate it. Mitch and JoJo picked up the pie pan and tossed it like a frisbee. Next, they stepped on it. Finally, they stepped and looked at me. I stepped on the pan, too. After that, and for the rest of the afternoon, we played soccer. Just before dark, when I walked home through the woods, I didn't want to pass Mrs. Turner's house because my friends and I, well, we don't have time for old ladies. That night, I laid in bed with the lights off and remembered the time I got sick at school. The nurse couldn't find my mother, and Mrs. Turner, well, she came to the school and picked me up. I started thinking about the pumpkin pie and wondered whether she made that whole pie for herself. I mean, maybe her family was coming, and after all, maybe that pie was for them. I woke up early next morning, even though it was a teacher work day and there wasn't any school, and I found Mom already up hard at work in the kitchen. She put a platter of pancakes and bacon on the table, and I piled food on my plate. "I'm going to visit Mrs. Turner today," I said with a full mouth. "What was that?" asked Mom. I swallowed and I said, "I'm going to visit Mrs. Turner today." "Well, that's very sweet of you. I'm afraid she's often lonely with her family living so far away." "I think her family might be coming this year." Mom smiled. "I hope so, and I hope you're right, but if they can't make it, would you invite her to eat Thanksgiving dinner with us?" "Sure." I moved the last piece of pancake around my plate. "And by the way, how do you make pumpkin pie?" "Most of the ingredients are things we already had, like eggs and flour. The only thing we would need is some canned pumpkin," said Mom. So I ran upstairs and got the money saved from my allowance. I pushed it down in my coat pocket, and I slipped downstairs out the front door, and then I walked down the street to Mr. Marshall's store. "Good morning," said Mr. Marshall. "Good morning," I said. "Do you have any canned pumpkin?" "On the day before Thanksgiving," Mr. Marshall chuckled, "we have a whole display of canned pumpkin. It's the end of aisle two." Well, I found the pumpkin and carried it to the cash register. As I felt around in my pockets for the money, I remembered the pan. "Do you have a pie pan?" "Aisle six, row three." Mr. Marshall rang up the order and said, "That'll be $4.89, please." I had to use almost all my money to pay him. On my way to Mrs. Turner's house, I wondered what I was going to say to her. She came to the kitchen door with a smile. "Is that you, Jonathan?" she asked. "Come on in. It's cold outside." I told her what happened the day before. "I was looking out the window when those boys came," said Mrs. Turner. "I saw you with them." "I'm sorry," I said, and I handed her the pumpkin in the bag with the new pie pan. She said the pumpkin on the counter and looked in the bag, and she said, what happened to the old pie pan?" "You don't want to know," I said, and I looked at my shoes. "Fair enough. Will you stay and help me make a new pie?" I stayed a long time, and we made two pies. Mrs. Turner said that I could take one home for my family's Thanksgiving dinner, and I asked if she would use the second for her family and their Thanksgiving dinner. Mrs. Turner smiled a little and told me that none of her family was coming for Thanksgiving this year. She picked up the second pie and looked at it, and she said, "I'll probably have to freeze half of my pie." That's when I remembered what Mom had said about inviting Mrs. Turner for Thanksgiving dinner. "Will you come and have dinner with us?" I asked. "Why, Jonathan, I'd love to." "You're not going to tell my parents what I did yesterday, are you?" Mrs. Turner didn't answer for a while. And finally she said, "I don't think that'll be necessary." Now, this story is, you know, a little sappy, as I warned everybody, but let me tell you what I'm thinking about. My grandfather, who I use in a lot of my stories, you know, I was in junior high. I'm 14 years old. I'm walking down the street and it's cold. It's snowing. And I just stole one of my mother's cigarettes and I'm puffing on it. I don't think anybody's around. My grandfather, of all people, walking up the street toward me in a snowstorm, watching me suck down a Camel. It was the most embarrassing thing that ever happened to me. And I just lifted my head and he looked at me and I didn't know what was going to happen, but he just took his finger and he, you know, just shook it. No, don't you do that. Never said a word, just shook his finger. Never ratted on me. To me, that's the reason I loved Mrs. Turner's story.
It was a great story. And I love hearing about your grandfather and your family.
It just reminded me of him, you know. Just reminded him.
Well, and you know what I loved about Stephen's story and about the story of your granddad is I do think if you're lucky enough to have people in your life that you admire, you do always think about making them proud and not disappointing them. When I came to stay with this family when I was in high school, I drank 3 liters of soda every single day. And the first few weeks I was with them, we went out to dinner. I started to order a soda, and the father looked at me and he said, "You will never order soda again." Well, I was visiting with him about a year ago, and I told him, I said, "You know what? I never ordered soda again." I mean, I just couldn't do it, you know? I couldn't possibly do something.
Tequila or bourbon, but no, never any soda.
That's a whole different topic. That's a whole different topic, Hank. Well, friends, this is Greg Audell with Tatiana Gago and the one and only Dr. Hank Rubicek and Floyd the Wonder Dog. And I hope you're enjoying So What's Your Story on this Thanksgiving 2019 with family tales to touch your hearts on KPFT Houston and 91.9 on the dial for our friends in Huntsville. Tatiana.
Hello, Greg.
Why don't you talk to us about this great storytelling town of ours?
Well, absolutely. Let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, because it's a great place to learn about the art of telling. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emanuel, and that's located at 1500 Sunset. There won't be a swap in December because the fourth Tuesday is Christmas Eve, but do plan to join the guild for their first swap of 2020 on January 28th. And be sure to bring a friend. And be sure to visit the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for information about all of their upcoming events. And while you're on the Guild's page, why not become a member?
Oh, yeah, that's nice.
You can do it online. Also, listen to some of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008, all listed on the menu under radio program. And if you don't own a radio, that's not a problem, because you can listen to a stream live on kpft.org and Facebook Live. We're also on YouTube. I guess you can say we're all over the place. And we also like to suggest some program ideas when visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page. And be sure to share it with your friends. And we'd love it if you'd like us when you leave. Got guests to suggest? Maybe yourself? Let us know by dropping us a note at story@kpft.org. And we promise to get back to you. And don't forget our friends at The Moth at Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of the month, where you'll enjoy some terrific stories. Next one is December 10th, with the perfect theme to usher in the holidays. In fact, it's tonight's theme, family. And for our listeners who want to take their storytelling skills to the next level, why not become a member of Tejas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network? Both also happen to be staunch supporters of our program. Greg, back to you.
Tatiana, I understand that we have a very, very special host. One of my all-time favorite people will be hosting next week. Would you announce who that host is and what her plans are for her show?
That is going to be me.
Oh, I guarantee you I will not be running the board, however.
No, we will find someone to replace me for that day.
Yeah. I may replace maybe me, and I'm a little nervous right now. Maybe Nick. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So maybe you'll be hearing Tatiana, but whether you hear her or not, she will be here conducting this show. Tell us about what you got planned, Tatiana.
So next week, I've been wanting to do this for such a long time. I've been wanting to do a fairy tale themed program. But instead of actually reading fairy tales, these people are going to be telling their own versions of fairy tales. Cinderella, Little Red Riding Hood, all of those like major
So will tales. You be dressing as a fairy?
Well, unfortunately not, because people can't see me. It's radio. But I'm going to be having students. They're going to be Josias Cantu, Bryce Calabasa, Marvin Deaver. All right. Students from Dr. Thomas's fairy tale course.
And they
course.
Rock. They're very good. They are very good. This is the real deal.
I've heard Marvin's story. Yeah. That's why I want him on here. It's right. going to be great.
And friends, while your host may rotate in and out weekly, Tatiana is here each and every week. Mm-hmm. So she kind of has a doctorate. And so what's your story?
Yeah, no, she's fabulous. There's no conceivable way we can do the show without Tatiana. No,
absolutely not.
Greg, you know, I want to revisit the thanks that we give our families, because I don't think we do it enough. And I want to start by thanking my wife. I know this sounds really hokey, but, you know, my wife, Peggy, and you know, all of you know her, is one of the kindest persons you'll ever know. And great spouses are genuinely very rare. Even more rare is expressing thanks for having a loving partner who isn't four-legged and furry. They're always wonderful. But my friend...
You know, one thing I want to say about your wife is when she was a guest on my show, she came up with a phrase that so perfectly encapsulated the job of a single mom.
She did.
As the designated doer of everything.
Right.
And I have used
that
a thousand times since then.
I know. Yeah, she didn't think she would do well that night. About a half hour before the show, she said at home, I'm going to bomb in her own inevitable way. But, you know, my friend, Dr. Walter Blanchard, shared a story about the way that he met his wife when he was in the studio on October 5th. But the setup is this. I asked him, it had nothing to do with Thanksgiving, but I did ask him, what are you most grateful for? It was a little banter that we had prior to this. It was about gratitude. And he brought that up. And I said, well, what are you most grateful for? And this is the story that he told. Listen to this. This is totally extemporaneous. This was not a story that I had thought he would tell based on the script. So it's very significant that we listen to this one. He is thankful for his wife, and this is a great little ditty about how he met her.
I was a high school student, football player, good student, got some breaks along the way, and was able to, because of my athletics, take some extra credits in the summer so that I could have more time during the football season to practice and be there. I found myself in a class where my football coach was the teacher. And the pretty girl that sat across the room from me caught my attention. He noticed it too. And he said, you know, if you'd pay more attention to the civics lesson instead of that blonde girl, you'd probably do better in this class. I knew I was going to make an A anyway, but that's the way he talked to me. So I thought about this blonde girl, this beautiful girl. She was a senior. I also noticed that every time she left the class, some boy was carrying her books. And I came home that day, and I told my mother, I said, boy, there's a great-looking girl in my civics class, and I'd love to ask her out. And my mother said, oh, pick up the phone. I said, well, you don't understand. You see, I'm a junior, and she's a senior, and she might turn me down. She said, well, so what if she turned you down? I said, well, you don't grasp this. You know, everybody would know she turned me down because that's how the word gets out at the school. She said, and so what? I said, Mother, you just don't get it like that. Well, one thing led to another, and one day after another, I watched that girl out of the corner of my eye, and every day she got prettier looking to me, and I kept thinking, I want to ask her out. And I would come home from time to time after school, and I told my mother, you know, I'm going to ask her out. But every time I reached for the phone, it weighed 1,000 pounds, and I couldn't pick it up because I just feared the rejection. I was a fairly confident guy, but with girls, I was pretty shy. Well, one day I came home from school, and my mother and I were having a Coke there, and the phone rang, and she picked it up. And she said, well, yes, he's right here. Hang on. And my mother handed me the phone, and she said, it's Sue on the phone. And I thought, be still my heart. Sue, my goodness. So I took the phone, and someone said, and by the way, I'd never talked to that blonde girl, so I had no idea what her voice was like. She said, would you like to go to the big dance with me? I said, of course, without any hesitation. She said, well, you'll have to wear a tuxedo. And I said, no problem. And she said, well, that's great. Let's talk in the morning at school, and we'll solidify things. I said, okay, good. And boy, I put the phone down. I felt so great. My mother said, what happened? I said, the very girl I wanted to ask out, the very girl, you know, has called me to ask me out. She said, see what I mean? I mean, you know, why were you ever worried in the first place? So on the way to school the next morning with my friends, we drove together. And I told them that the senior, the most beautiful senior in the class, had asked me to the big dance. Well, these guys thought, man, I don't think you deserve that, but I'm glad you got it, and good for you. We used to meet in the cafeteria like all kids do at most high schools. Walked in that morning, I looked around, and I didn't see that girl, but another girl came walking up. And she said, I'm so glad that you agreed to go to the dance. It was another Sue. I couldn't believe it. My friends were laughing, and the girl said, what are they laughing about? I said, it's nothing. Don't worry about that. She said, well, we'll go to the dance, and I'm going to give you my address, and here's my phone number. And I went, okay, great. They gave me a hard time. I went home that afternoon and told my mother that the wrong Sue had called me. She said, well, it's not the wrong Sue. It's just another Sue. I said, Mother, she said, you are going to take her to the dance. I said, no, I'll take her for sure. So I grumbled. The dance came, the day of the dance. I washed the car. I picked up the corsage I'd ordered for. I picked up the tuxedo. I dressed up, and I went to this girl's house. This girl was a year younger than me, so she was actually 2 years younger than the blonde girl I described earlier in the story. I knocked on the door. Her mother and father were there. And I looked up at the top of the stairs, and this was a different creature. She had her hair done, her fingernails. Her mother had built her a dress. She looked gorgeous. She came down the stairs with a beautiful smile. Her father took two rolls of film on an old Kodak camera with us, the same pose over and over again, with me smiling. We walked out to the car. We went to the dance. She was a delightful date. One thing led to another, and we went out to, you know, dinner with some other people. I didn't know it that we were going out to dinner, and frankly, I was completely broke by the time I had bought the corsage and rented the tuxedo, and somehow she sensed that. And despite everybody ordering lobster and other things, you know, we were all excited, you know, she turned to me and said, I'm not very hungry. How about you? And I said, not really. So we bought a $2 appetizer, you know, and shared it. And I took her home that night, kissed her on the steps. I know her parents were looking through the blinds. And she said, I've had the time of my life. And she walked inside. I felt great. I undid my bow tie. I turned the windows down in the car. I drove around for a long time thinking about things. So when I came home that night, my mother was still up. She used to stay up for me. How was it? I said, it was great. She said, well, what about that other girl? I said, I'm going to call her tomorrow. I don't have any problem with that. I reached for that phone and called it. And that girl said, I'd be great, be glad to go out with you. And so we went out, and now we've been married 50 years.
Well, that's downright romantic.
Downright.
What a nice story.
Yeah. You know, and it's a simple one, and but it was totally extemporaneous. He had not planned on telling that story. He just talked about what he was really grateful for, his wife. And I thought it was beautiful.
Well, I think sometimes those that come directly from the heart without a whole lot of thought are sometimes the best stories. Hey, Tatiana,
yeah.
What are you most thankful for this Thanksgiving?
Oh, there is a list of things, but, you know, just overall this year, there have been a lot of opportunities and challenges. I'm very thankful for all of those. I'm thankful for being here. I'm thankful for my family, of course. I'm thankful for my boyfriend, who I know is listening right now to this. But there's just so many things I could go on, but those have to be the main things that I'm thankful for.
How about you, Hank?
Well, you know, my list is not very profound. My friends are everything to me, and I just have to start with that. Even the stories that I've told recently have been about my friends, as you know. But you and Warren, Mary, Eric, you know, Paul, you know, Christy, and the beat goes on. The people that I know in the storytelling community, friends that I've known forever, Tatiana, people in my life are people who define me, and I really think that it is all about people for me now.
Well, you can't beat people, and I would concur. That is certainly the number one thing on my list are the people and dog, Floyd the Wonder Dog, in my life. I mean, they make every day better, the struggles more bearable, and the good times better. I'm also thankful for the opportunity, Hank, that you've given me to be on this show for 4 years now. I cannot believe that, and that this little studio has become my second home. The amazing speaking opportunities that have come from being on this show, from being the keynote speaker at the Lord of the Streets luncheon to giving a talk in Korea, none of that would have happened without you and without this show and this special team that makes it up.
I would have asked for a commission if I would have known all of that has happened. Boy, my pleasure.
Talk to me after my network
Great
deal
stuff.
Comes through.
Great stuff.
And I got to say, I'm thankful to the Houston arts community that we're all a part of.
Yep.
I mean, this town, people don't understand what a theater-going, storytelling, writing town this is. And to be a part of it is a true blessing. And I hope to have new and exciting projects for 2020 to announce pretty soon.
I had, and you're going to do great stuff. But, you know, it occurred to me that I had hosted Nadia Keim on December 19th, 2018, in what I think proved to be one of the first stories about love and appreciation from an individual who came out. You know, you were talking about our storytelling community, and Nadia is one of the best storytellers I've heard. She's one of many, but she's really sensational. And this is a story about coming out. It's this beautiful story of love and appreciation. Let's listen to Nadia.
My name's Nadia Keim, and I was on the show just last month, and I'm probably best known for my collaboration Gone Awry at the Gay Club. And when I'm not telling stories, I'm working in public health and giving back to the city. My background, I feel it's really pivotal to a lot of my stories. My mother's from the Philippines and my father's from Iran. And this particular Thanksgiving story is actually about my partner Shannon's first Thanksgiving with my family. So we had been dating steadily for a few months, and of course, things are going so well. You should totally meet the family. So we figured it was time for her to meet my mom's side of the family. She had met a good bit of my father's side of the family. And she had already met my sister and my parents. So we figured, all right, let's get two birds with one stone. We're going to do a holiday and you're going to meet the family. Done. So two flaws in this plan. One, I forgot to mention that we spent Thanksgiving at a casino. And two, I haven't officially come out to grandma. So there are a few things we have to worry about here. So the first bit, we discovered, I was asking Shannon, well, should we drive up on Wednesday night? Or how long are we staying, one night or two nights? And she was like, what are you talking about? Why are we staying the night? It's like, oh, well, because we have to drive out to Lake Charles. That's where Thanksgiving is. She's like, you celebrate Thanksgiving at the casino? Is that weird? Well, apparently it is weird. So some things start coming up, and it's like, well, we were trying to save money. Well, don't worry about it. We you know, my uncle's a high roller. We get a free room. Don't worry about it. Okay, well, what about the dogs? And boarding dogs, it gets expensive. So we boarded my dog, Goaty. And that was already like $50-$60. And we had a 6-pound Chihuahua Mini, as in Mini Cooper, not Minnie Mouse. And we were like, what are we going to do with Mini? We can't afford to dish out like another $50-$60 on a 6-pound dog. That's like $10 a pound, you know? So, all right, we got it. We're going to put her into a backpack and we're going to like pad it with a jacket. We're just going to smuggle her into the casino, into the hotel room. What could possibly go wrong? Just in case something does go wrong, let's go ahead. We found her this tiny therapy dog vest, just in case, you know, just because we didn't have enough things to worry about, like, going wrong during this whole ordeal. Yeah, let's just add on that we could be lying about something kind of serious, right? So we get to the casino, and I go to the room, and we get situated, and I'm getting Minnie set up. You know, I'm setting up her bed and some pads and this sort of thing. And my sister, Nika, says, hey, Shannon, you want to come down to the casino with me and help rally up, you know, rally up the family for the buffet? Shannon's such a trooper. She was like, yeah, absolutely. So Nika takes Shannon to help round up the family, and she meets my uncle, and they go to the VIP lounge. So there are about 12 people here in our group, and out of the 12 people, we have my uncle and my cousin, and those are the high rollers. And they're the reasons why we get free rooms for all of the family, and they're allowed to bring two guests at a time into the VIP lounge. And in the VIP lounge, there are free drinks. So my family has devised a system to where all of us get free drinks, but we rotate at just the right time to where, all right, uncle takes the parents in first. Okay, cousin's going to take in the two cousins next. Everyone gets free drinks. Next hour, we check in and do it all over again. So they meet up with the uncle and, all right, so we've got uncle, Shannon, sister. Let's continue hunting down the rest of the family. So they get to the penny slots and they're in grandma's domain. And if you want to summon a Filipino grandma, basically you just stand in the penny slots area and just like shake a bag of change really fast 14 times. And a 5-foot Filipino woman with tattooed eyebrows will just appear out of nowhere. So Shannon meets her with a handshake. Coast is still clear. Grandma doesn't know. We're still good. So they're continuing this journey of like gathering all the family members, and they get to these touchscreen slot machines, and that's where my parents are. And this particular slot machine that they like to play on, it's Asian theme, and there are robed babies delivering like tokens of good luck in red envelopes, and then there are these flags on, or these frogs on golden lily pads. And my mom sees my uncle approaching, and very solemnly she says, I've already rubbed the frogs. The machine's gone cold. It's not paying out. And my uncle responds immediately, but did you rub the babies? That's the only way the machine's going to pay out. And very, very serious about it, right? So this is when I come in, and I come into a very confused Shannon. And I'm like, what did I miss? She says, I'll tell you about it later. So we go to the buffet, and thus begins the inquisition of the vegetarian. Shannon's a vegetarian, and my family just can't wrap their heads around it. So, and my aunt is like, so no fish? No, it's an animal. Well, what if it's in a soup? No, it's still an animal. Well, what do you eat? Well, vegetables and tofu and so on and so forth. And that's it. That's pretty much all the buffet. So we go to bed, and she's clearly processing things because she's not really giving me a lot of feedback. So we're checking out the next morning. We're going through breakfast, and thus begins the inquisition of the vegetarian's therapy dog, because Shannon was holding Minnie in her arms with the vest on, just in case, right? So my aunt is like, what kind of dog is it? Well, she's a Chihuahua. Oh, why is she a therapy dog? Well, because I have anxiety. What do you have anxiety about? I just met you. And thus, it continues forever. So we're on the drive home, and I don't know how many miles we drove, but it took a while. We had to cross through a few counties before she finally was just like, that was weird. I was worried about all the things that we didn't even have to worry about. We were still didn't have to worry about grandma, and the casino turned out fine, but now whenever we have to get ready for family functions and all that sort of thing, we have this whole other set of anxieties.
The anxiety over exactly. Being vegetarian. Oh my God. Game's okay.
Yeah, I want to explain that this story is so neat because it was really in the banter that we learned that Nadia's parents are so understanding and open-minded about her coming out and her partner, and it was just a really neat discovery on her part in telling the story. It was really terrific. You know, one of the things that, and I know, Greg, you're the same way, when we think about Thanksgiving, we sometimes think about the fact that, you know, we'd all like a lot more, but we are so happy with what we have. And we are. And just to shift to another story genre to make that point, this is a popular, quick-hitting Aesop's fable that we should never forget. It's the goose and the golden eggs. There was once a man who had the most wonderful goose you can imagine. Every day when the man visited the nest, the goose had laid a beautiful, glittering golden egg. The man took the golden eggs to market and soon began to get rich. He happily bought fine foods and fine clothes with his money. Before long, the man wanted to own a fine house, too. But the goose could only give him a single golden egg a day. He was not getting rich fast enough buying to buy a large house. And then one day, after he had finished counting his money, an idea came to him. "I could get all the golden eggs at once if I killed the goose and cut it open," he said. But when the deed was done, not a single golden egg did he find. His precious goose was dead and could make no more golden eggs. It's a simple parable, really. Those who have plenty often want more and may end up losing all they have. I don't know why that's considered to be a children's fable. It's a little harsh.
I don't think I'll be reading that to any kids in my life.
No. I think we could probably modify it a bit, but nevertheless. And this is one last story for the evening. This is, I think, a very touching story that really summarizes everything that we've talked about tonight and catapults us into every other notion about giving thanks. It's a story written by a teacher who's wants to remain nameless. When Mrs. Klein told her first graders to draw a picture of something for which they were thankful, she thought how little these children who lived in a deteriorating neighborhood actually had to be thankful for. She knew that most of the class would draw pictures of turkeys or of bountiful laden Thanksgiving tables. That was what they believed was expected of them. What took Mrs. Klein aback was Douglas's picture. Douglas was so forlorn, he was likely to be found close to her shadow as they went outside for recess. Douglas's drawing was simply this. It was a hand, obviously, but whose hand? The class was captivated by his image. "I think it was the hand of God that brings us food," said one student. "Maybe a farmer," said another, "because they grow the turkeys. It looks more like a policeman. The ones who protect us, I think," said Lavinia, who was also so very serious as a student, "that it is supposed to be all of the hands that help us, but Douglas could only draw one of them." Mrs. Klein had almost forgotten Douglas in her pleasure at finding the class so responsive. When she had the others at work on another project, she bent over his desk and asked whose hand it was. And Douglas mumbled, "It's yours, teacher." And then Mrs. Klein recalled that she had taken Douglas by the hand from time to time. She often did that with the children, but that it should have meant so much to Douglas was amazing. Perhaps, she reflected, this was her Thanksgiving and everybody's Thanksgiving. Not the material things given unto us, but the small ways that we give something to others.
What a beautiful story.
Isn't that amazing?
That really is.
Yeah, it's all about things that matter. It's all about things that people remember. You know, every once in a while, you know, I've taught forever. And I'm retired, although technically I'm still teaching. And I took them all down and they're all sitting in a wonderful box in my at home, but I had 400, I know how many because I counted them, 416 letters, notes written by students over the years, little notes, you know, wow. things like, you know, "Dr. Rubicek, thank you for this." And most of them are just quick thank yous about saying a nice thing to them in class or them doing a project that they felt really good about, but I somehow made them feel better. Or even some students who said, you know, you kind of caught me on something. You told me I didn't do well, and I was really angry with you, and I realized that you're right, I didn't do well. I mean, it was a tremendous range. Thank you notes, little pieces of paper, post-its, you name it. And there's nothing that means more than those words. Making an impression on people somehow is everything. It's what everything is about.
What's also nice is when something you've said or done without much thought you learn later had that effect on someone else, and you weren't even trying to.
Right.
You know, and the other thing I find is with the young children in my life, they're not jaded by life yet. And they notice the things, and they'll tell you, you know, the things they appreciate. I'm like, wow, at what age do we lose that? At what age do we, you know, stop saying to someone, you know, I like being with you because you make me happy. Right. You know, at some age we're like, oh, you can't say that to a friend.
Yeah, it's a shame. Yeah. Can't believe we're done tonight, man.
I know. This was a wonderful show. Tatiana, thank you. And Dr. Hank, thank you. And along with our retellers that we had on tape. Tonight, we give thanks to friends, family, and memories that make our lives more meaningful. The So What's Your Story team wants to add you, our listeners, who make it possible for us to bring great storytellers to your lives each and every week. As we close out tonight, instead of a little more of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch, we're going to be listening to my favorite Thanksgiving song. Yes, there are Thanksgiving songs. Alice's Restaurant by the great Arlo Guthrie, which is also known as the Thanksgiving Day Massacre. And not only is this song special for the day of Thanksgiving, but it's also special to KPFT. Because when we were bombed off the air for the second time in 1970, this song was what was playing. When we came back on the air 3 months later, Arlo Guthrie himself flew into the studio and picked up the song right where it left off 3 months ago. And if you've never heard Alice's Restaurant, we're not going to play the whole 18 minutes for you, but I urge you to pull it up on YouTube as soon as we sign off. But friends, first, don't touch that dial, because Lars and the Tennis and Tape Deck is up next with his usual sweet mix of singer-songwriters. So make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling out, join us each and every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we will keep bringing them to you. This is Greg Audell, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace, my friends.
Friendly gesture for us to take the garbage down to the city dump. So we took the half a ton of garbage, put it in the back of a red VW microbus, took shovels and rakes and implements of destruction, and headed on toward the city dump. Well, we got there, and there's a big sign and a chain across the...
KPFT makes a difference, with real people, real stories, and real voices.
I was put in a room where I was hung by my arms. I couldn't sit down, I couldn't rest, all the time with a bag over my head.
Whether it's hearing music that opens your mind or radio that stirs your soul, you know you can count on KPFT to bring you the stories and the people behind the stories.
The shock doctrine, what I'm calling the shock doctrine, is a philosophy of power. It's a doctrine of domination.
This is radio worth supporting, and you make a difference. Visit kpft.org to view our complete program schedule. Give feedback on our shows or pledge online. This is listener-sponsored, commercial-free Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Helping out at KPFT isn't all meetings and telephones.
One committee works your brain and your body.
And we don't mean throwing things at each other.
The building committee handles structural improvements to KPFT.
From new shelving to sheetrocking to a wheelchair access ramp, the building committee makes a difference in what's on the air by keeping KPFT studios in shape.
We're a committee composed of volunteers who care about KPFT, and we're happy to get our hands dirty to help the station.
Workdays are conveniently scheduled on weekends, and you'll get to meet lots of fellow listeners, have oodles of fun, and make a difference.
So what are you waiting for? Put your hands to work helping your community radio station.
Call 713-526-4000 for more information about KPFT's building committee.
We meet regularly at the studio, 419 Lovett Boulevard.
Don't forget to wear some work clothes and a smile.